candidate. That does it for today's broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, it's Shenna from Pacific Underground, the radio show where Asians and Pacific Islanders take the mic into our own hands. Join us this Friday at 9 a.m. for a special live episode where the entire Pacific Underground crew will join me for a lively roundtable discussion about new political policies affecting Asians and Pacific Islanders. We'll also have live interviews and we'll be taking your calls to talk about what's important to you and your API community. So tune in for a special Pacific Underground this Friday, February 3rd at 9 a.m. right here on KBOO, your community radio station.
This is Love Jones, producer of the World Famous Confessional. This year, Contessa de la Luna brings you a real bona fide Wild West jamboree and variety show. We've got live performances by Contessa de la Luna and Courtney Vondrell from Three Leg Torso, plus audience lasso contests, sock puppet theater, surprise fun box drawing, many other prizes. We've got performances by the Sea Charms and a selfie booth with Contessa de la Luna. We've got plenty of surprises and fun in store, so mark your calendars Thursday, February 9th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds benefit KBOO, your community radio station. Tickets are available now online at contessawestern.brownpapertickets.com or at the door the night of the event. Get your hat, get your spurs, and come on down Thursday, February 9th at the Clinton Street Theater starting at 7 p.m. Contessa de la Luna's Wild West Jamboree, an old-time variety show.
It is 5 p.m. and KBOO Evening News is coming up next. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the trial of Oregon activist Ken Ward ends in a hung jury.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown has formed a Trump resistance team.
Oregon Senators Wyden and Merkley have come out opposed to Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 1st, 2017. I'm Ray Bodwell.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. The trial of environmental activist, Valve Turner, and Corbett resident Ken Ward ended today in a hung jury. The trial took place in Mount Vernon, Washington. A climate activist, Ward faced up to 30 years in prison for shutting down the Trans Mountain Pipeline in Skagit County. Ward's action was a planned protest enacted at the same time that other valve turners in Minnesota, North Dakota, and Montana turned off oil pipelines. The judge in this case, Michael Rickert, had denied Ward the necessity defense, expressing his doubts about the existence of climate change and the role of humans in global warming.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown has sent a message to supporters asking them to join a social action team to resist the Trump administration. The email was sent out by Brown's re-election team on Tuesday and said Trump's first actions had, quote, attacked our values as Americans and Oregonians. The email was sent out after it was learned that Oregon had been left off an early list of potential infrastructure projects that were slated to receive federal funding. According to Brown's re-election team, the primary purpose of the email was to promote the governor and her progressive policies, not to rally voters against Trump. Oregon's Democratic congressional representatives have been particularly harsh critics of the president during the early days of his presidency, prompting fears of a backlash from the notoriously thin-skinned Trump.
Jazz Downtown is not dead since the closure of Jimmy Max, just on hiatus. Frank Fallians, owner of the Star Theater, and Manish Patel, owner of Bar 15, have purchased the recently closed Rialto on Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. They announced the basement Jack London Bar will feature live jazz and will encourage younger local musicians. A tribute show in late April will feature some of Jimmy Mack's regulars. The nearly century-old Rialto has two other rooms, formerly a bar and a pool room, but the new owners have not yet announced their plans for those spaces.
The Renew Oregon Coalition has issued a report card on the state's transition towards clean power. Brad Reed, executive director of the coalition, said that the state receives high marks for how it produces power, but can improve on clean transit. The Oregon News Service and KBOO's Khalid Mosley have this report.
A new report card on Oregon's transition to clean energy shows a mix of successes and failures. The state received the A- for the ways it produced power, getting high marks for passing the Clean Electricity and Coal Transition Act, which ensured the states would get 80% of power from renewable energy by 2040. However, it received a C- for transportation. The report by the Renew Oregon Coalition notes a lack of electric vehicles, for instance, which it says are now cost-efficient options for mass transit. However, Brad Reed, Communication Director for Renew Oregon, says the state's transition away from fossil fuels is good news for the clean energy job market.
Job growth is about 11%, which is higher than the state average. And we're talking about all kinds of workers, construction workers, engineers, designers, manufacturing workers, salespeople, secretaries, custodians. These folks are all part of the clean energy economy.
Oregon received a B- for its buildings. And the report says the state slipped from 4th to 7th in the state rankings of energy efficient policies for its infrastructure. Its worst marks were for climate equity. Oregon received a D. The report notes that state across the country struggle to achieve environmental justice for disadvantaged communities. The Oregon legislative session kicks off today, and clean energy advocates are looking to legislators to report suggests putting a price on pollution could be the way to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Reed says there are multiple ways the state could do this, and that his organization is waiting to see what lawmakers propose.
What's important is that we take the collected proceeds and reinvest them into communities so that not only improves health by reducing pollution, but also to grow local jobs that can't be outsourced.
Price and pollution has proved to be controversial. In the 2016 election, voters to the north in Washington rejected a proposal for what had been the nation's first carbon tax. Environmental groups opposed the tax because they were concerned the revenue earned from it would not be invested in clean energy solutions in communities affected by climate change.
For the Oregon News Service and KBOO, I am Khalid Mosley. Have a good day.
Lawyers for a girl who they say was raped in the bathroom of a Boys and Girls Club in Ontario, Oregon in 2011 have filed a $5 million lawsuit against the youth organization. The girl, referred to as Amy Doe in court documents, was 7 years old at the time. Portland attorney Peter Jancy said the rape occurred during regular hours. Her assailant, who was 14 at the time, is alleged to have sexually assaulted three other young girls previously. He trapped the young victim in a single-use bathroom and raped her. The lawyer said that his client was especially vulnerable because of her physical and mental disabilities. The lawsuit claims that the Boys and Girls Club have failed to implement adequate child protection measures, make its premises safe, and properly train staff on how to lessen the risks of attacks. This is not the first time that the Boys and Girls Clubs in Oregon have made headlines because of sexual attacks. In 2010, a 15-year-old volunteer at the Boys and Girls Club in Forest Grove abused a 5-year-old girl. In 2014, a 23-year-old volunteer with the Boys and Girls Club in Northeast Portland was found guilty of third-degree rape and luring a minor. And last week, an attorney for a 10-year-old girl who says she was molested in 2016 by a 13-year-old male volunteer at an after-school Boys and Girls Club program in a Northeast Portland school filed a $1.1 million lawsuit.
If you've been outside, it will come as no surprise that Portland is under a high wind advisory through early Friday morning. You can expect sustained winds of 20 to 30 miles an hour with gusts as high as 40 to 50. On Thursday, we can expect light snow and or freezing rain to arrive midday. Current forecasts call for 1 to 2 inches of snow and possibly as much as 1/4 inch of ice. With the severe weather forecast for the next 2 days, individuals in need of shelter are reminded to call 211 or go to www.211info.org on the web for information on available warming shelters.
As mentioned, the forecast for the next 2 days calls for low temperatures, high winds, and freezing rain or snow. During the January wave of extreme cold and snow, many Portlanders stepped up to provide food and shelter to people struggling to survive on the street. American Legion Post opened their door to many and provided food and a warm place to sleep. They had the support of the community and the local group Free Hot Soup. Recently, members shared some thoughts on the experience with KBOO's Ray Bodwell.
American Legion Post 134 is located at 21st and Northeast Alberta in Portland. During the recent cold snap, the post turned itself into an impromptu warming shelter, providing food and safe place to sleep to many. With me are post members Seth Grant, Sean Davis, and Al Artero, as well as Wendy Bukowski of Free Hot Soup. They're here to tell us about their collaborative efforts. Gentlemen, let's start with you. Please tell me about what you've been doing.
I guess it all really started kind of the Tuesday after, you know, the real cold weather started. You know, our post, we have a little bar in there. We see up on the news that a person had died, you know, on the streets due to the cold weather. And just kind of looking around, kind of had the realization that we are a private club and we can do whatever the hell we want. And that it was time for us to kind of begin a response to this. I think what was initially in our minds, what that response was initially in our minds was one thing. What it grew into over these past 2 weeks was definitely another thing.
So how did you get started with this effort? What were the first things you did?
We had the idea to do a warming shelter, but then it was just going to be a daytime thing because there's hardly any day warming shelters in the city. But then, obviously, it gets colder at night, and by the time we got a couple people in there, I'm like, we can't have them leave. They have no place to go. So we just decided to turn it into a full-on shelter. We weren't expecting too much. We put on a pot of coffee, threw some Progresso soups into one crock pot, and that night we had, six crock pots, people bringing in soup from the community. You know, the overwhelming response to the community really helped us evolve what we were going to do.
On any given night, how many folks were you feeding and sheltering?
Our first night, we had 8 people. We projected our capacity to be about 20, 25 if we were really shoving folks in. Our last night, we had 29.
But we wouldn't turn anybody away. And that 29 was just the mats, right? We still had a lot of people. Our the regulars that we started to get started helping out as well and became staff, and they would stay up all night with us. And so they wouldn't even have a mat, but they should have been counted.
You make it sound like some of the folks who originally came seeking shelter actually ended up turning into volunteers themselves. Is that the case?
After a couple of days, they were completely indistinguishable from post members or friends of ours that were coming in. They understood the standard operating procedures that we had, the rules that we had set up. They even in some ways played a part in crafting those rules, and they were a massive help to us. It wouldn't have gone as smoothly without them, and especially when I say that you're dealing with such a wide range of people, and you have, I've never lived on the streets, Sean, Seth has never lived on the streets, and so to have someone who comes from a point of being a peer, it was an amazing asset to us. That was huge.
Yeah, you know, one day I had somebody came in, and Ted was talking to him, Ted was one of our regulars, and the guy is like, well, I don't know if you guys really understand us, and Ted's like, I'm one of us. I'm us, man, you know, and it was a really beautiful moment, you know, to be able to meet those needs that we didn't even know existed was really an amazing thing.
It's finally starting to warm up, but it's still early in the winter. Do you expect to be doing this again?
I think that's still something we've yet to come to a point on. Certainly when things get abnormally cold into the teens, that's not normal around here.
Right.
The houseless population, there's certainly, you know, accustomed to and adaptable to the normal Oregon climate, but when you start seeing things like hypothermic fatalities, most recently, you know, a dead newborn that was a hypothermia victim, those types of incidents are really the catalyst for us to act. We stepped up as an emergency shelter to fill that very short-term window. And we felt really comfortable in shutting our operations down once we saw that the city of Portland was able to then spin up their operations a week, 2 weeks into things, getting community centers open that weren't prior warming shelters, so we could comfortably scale our operations back. But that initial step up, that initial emergent window, they just don't have the capacity to step up and operate in that timeline.
You three are all Iraq veterans. How did that training and that experience factor into what you did?
It was an instinct. You know, Seth was a medic in war in Iraq, and Al and I were infantrymen over there. I mean, we've been to communities and we've helped out. To be able to do it here and not thousands of miles away, it means a lot, you know, and be able to use those skills again.
The only way I can say is it was a species of therapy of us kind of instinctively relying on a skill set that is largely unused, back in this world for us, and because we don't really know how to employ it. We operated at that high intensity level with a great command structure, with moving supplies in and out, coordinating with people all over the city, runners all over the city, other organizations, seamlessly being told that we were one of the best run shelters that they've ever seen 2 days into this, and we didn't even know what we were doing. And it was really nice to see this thing that exists in me see it be able to kind of take shape in a new way. And I've said this before, I said this to these guys, like, we're not walking out of this the same people that when we walked into this.
It sounds like you were very successful with your spur of the moment efforts, and it also sounds to me like that there are learnings that you could share with other shelters and other agencies. What are your thoughts?
It's an interesting point you bring up there. We had a couple of our guests, you know, our guests span the gamut from folks that were chronically houseless, substance issues, to somebody you'd meet on the street and, you know, you think this person has an absolutely normal life, owns a home, etc. There was a guy who was probably mid-20s, and he came up to me one day and he says, you know, I've had to bounce around shelters. This is the first place that I actually felt safe enough that I could get a decent night's sleep. I was able to get up, go get work for the day. I made some money, and I could see that there was some life in his eye. We'd have people call up and ask, you know, is this a safe place? We're really not sure. We've been to other shelters. And I think if I got you right, his default line was, look, we're a bunch of qualified combat veteran ass kickers. You are in a safe place. And I can't tell you, without saying those direct words or in that verbiage, folks did feel safe, and they were able to come in. It was phenomenal, because we heard the horror stories of other shelters.
And not to say we didn't have our problems. We definitely had problems.
Yeah, after a couple of days, I really think that we found our lane. We worked with 211 really well, and we basically explained to them exactly what our needs were and what we were capable of. We never felt that while we were being an asset to the city's response, that we were put up into a position to fail. And that is amazing, and it was great, a large part of our success. But another thing was that we just, like every single person that came in, we made it a point, and I think that, like, preempted a lot of the problems, was just showed love. I mean, like we never made anybody feel like a burden when they came in. It was just right off the bat, you know, a couple of volunteers were just, like, right on them. Hey, let's get some coffee in you. Let's get some, you know, hot food in you.
Ask them what their name is.
Ask them what their name was. Like, so just start talking to them while they're eating. And meanwhile, we're, you know, having the conversation of, you know, are your shoes wet? Do you need some warm socks? Do you need these things? Hey, do you want to stay for the night? Hey, I'll just go make you a bed right now. And they actually watch us, like, make them. And it's not just, like, you know, a pad and a blanket, you know, right. I mean, they were pads and blankets, but we just did it with a little bit extra care. And that was, and I think that there is a necessary armor that a lot of these folks need out on the street. But when you're in such a small space like our post, that armor isn't necessarily an asset.
Wendy, how did Free Hot Soup get involved?
Well, we responded to the donations drive that Post 134 was putting on. And so in Free Hot Soup Mobile PDX, we have a wonderful community of runners that take items of warmth and survival items to those encampments directly on the streets and deliver them into their hands. For example, if we find somebody that needs gloves, we have gloves in our car, and then we just put them on their hands or offer them to them with some hand warmers and so on and so forth. So when we've learned that Post 134 was having this donations drive, then our runners then went there to go collect these items of warmth. In turn, we were able to take hot soup and cocoa, and that's how we connected.
I want to say, like, first and foremost, that if, like, the people of Portland don't know who Freak Hot Soup is, you need to acquaint yourself with it, because those are, like, some of the most amazing young people in Portland.
The doers.
So inspired by them that if you don't know who they are, if you're not donating to them, if you're not trying to get involved in what they do, you're wrong. They were so incredible, and I think that some of what our success was just basically just trying to keep up with them.
For people that are not familiar with your organization, can you give us a quick overview of Free Hot Soup?
Well, Free Hot Soup started approximately 3 years ago in December, I think, December 13th, somewhere around there, in response to inclement weather. And then after the inclement weather passed, there was a lot of people and volunteers that wanted to do direct service. So people can join us on Free Hot Soup, the main page, which is dedicated to direct service logistics and coordinating. Or if you're interested in becoming a part of our mobile teams, you can join us on Free Hot Soup Mobile, PDX, and it's on Facebook. And our community guidelines are set as such that we are free of religious and political ties. We are there just united by huge hearts and the desire to help people that are less fortunate and prevent any more deaths on the streets. No more bodies, no more babies dead.
Well, let me finish up by thanking you all for coming down to the station to share the story. But I think it's more important to actually thank you for what you've done. You have set a wonderful example for us all. For KBOO, this is...
In response to a letter from the Portland Tenants Union, Mayor Ted Wheeler and Multnomah County Chair Deborah Caffery posted an online request to local landlords. The post asked landlords, in light of recent snowstorms, to show some consideration to tenants who've lost income because of travel difficulties and workplace closures. They've asked landlords to work out a payment plan instead of issuing non-payment notices. Tomorrow, the City Council will vote on Commissioner Udaly's proposal to require landlords to contribute to tenants' moving costs in the case of no-cause evictions or significant rent increases. And tonight, possible snow and freezing rain.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Kitchen Table Conversations at 6. At 7, it's Keeping It Real with news, music, and listener comments. Tonight's weather in Portland will be mostly cloudy with 33-mile-per-hour east winds gusting up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow, we'll have the same high wind with a chance of snow after 4. Today in history, in 1961, Texas seceded from the Union, becoming the 6th state to do so. Some hope that one day history will repeat itself. Today's quote is from actor Malcolm McDowell. The definition of insanity in Texas is so insane that it's impossible to be insane in Texas.
In this week's Poetic Justice, KBOO's Dan Raphael explores how democracy can be like a lobster.
It's said the humane way to kill a crab or lobster is putting it into a pot, raising the temperature slowly to lull the creature to permanent sleep. So our democracy has been slowly lulled into dissolution for 4 decades. Defund schools for dumber voters, increase restrictions and difficulties for voters, tweak tax laws and corporate welfare to make the rich richer while cutting back wages, benefits, and assistance to make more poor. What do we got? Oligarchy. How do we fix it? Is it too late for a popular uproar? The White House and Republican lawmakers no longer take our calls or read our petitions. Must more fall apart before we can get enough together? How far down the road to fascism do we have to go before we can change course? And you don't believe we're on the eve of Trumpstruction. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
As anticipated, the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court has been met with a firestorm of controversy. Judge Gorsuch, who currently serves as the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals judge in Colorado, has been described as extremely conservative and a strict interpreter of the Constitution. Traits that he shares with the late Justice Antonin Scalia, the man he was named to replace. Evangelical Christians were thrilled with the nomination. Russell Moore of the Southern Baptist Convention called Gorsuch a, quote, brilliant and articulate defender of constitutional originalism. Progressives were not as effusive. Oregon's Democratic Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley have come out strongly against Supreme Court nominee Judge Neil Gorsuch. Wyden called the Gorsuch nomination, quote, a breathtaking retreat from the notion that Americans have a fundamental right to constitutional liberties. Merkley indicated his intention to block the Gorsuch nomination in response to the Republicans' previous failure to act on Merrick Garland, former President Obama's pick. Merkley stated, quote, this is the first time in American history that one party has blockaded a nominee for almost a year in order to deliver a seat to a president of their own party. President Trump has suggested that Republicans should not tolerate any Democratic obstruction to his nomination and suggested that Senate Republicans be willing to invoke the, quote, nuclear option if Democrats attempt to filibuster the nomination. The nuclear option is a parliamentary procedure that allows the U.S. Senate to override a rule of precedent by a simple majority of 51 votes instead of the supermajority of 60 votes that is necessary to end a filibuster. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell recently stated that he was not in favor of the nuclear option, since the Republicans would not always be in the majority and it could work against them in the future. But in the hostile atmosphere of the current Congress and the hyper-aggressive behavior of the Trump administration, it's safe to say that all bets are off.
The Senate Finance Committee changed its rules mid-game Wednesday, making a parliamentary end-run around a Democratic boycott of two highly controversial cabinet nominations. Hours later, the same strategies played out at the Environmental and Public Works Committee. Meanwhile, the nomination of Senator Jeff Sessions passed out of the Judiciary Committee today along an 11-9 party line vote. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
The chairman of the Senate Finance Committee convened an early morning executive session to suspend the rules that define the quorum necessary for the committee to do business. The move came after Democrats blocked action on two cabinet posts by boycotting the vote. Under its prevailing rules, specifically Rule 4, no less than one-third of the committee's 26 members must be present, including at least one member from each party. Votes were scheduled Tuesday on advancing both Treasury Secretary nominee Steven Mnuchin and President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Tom Price. Both were delayed when the entire contingent of Democrats on the Finance Committee boycotted the meeting, robbing the body of the required quorum. But a deeper read of the rules finds Rule 19, which allows the committee to suspend any of its rules at any time. So that's what the Republican majority did. Wednesday morning, before any other scheduled meetings got underway, Chairman Orrin Hatch convened the meeting. All 14 Republicans on the committee showed up, filling their side of the horseshoe-shaped dais in the committee room. All chairs on the Democrat side remained empty. Georgia Senator Johnny Isakson and Committee Chairman Orrin Hatch carried out the parliamentary play.
Mr. Chairman, I ask unanimous consent that we temporarily suspend the Rule 4 and all other applicable Finance Committee rules of procedure to report out the nominations of Steven Mnuchin as Secretary of Treasury and Dr. Thomas Price as Secretary of Health and Human Services, and that all other rules come back in operation at the conclusion of today's vote.
Pursuant to Rule 2A of the committee rules, the chair rules that the unanimous consent request is not germane as it was not part of the original notice of this executive session. The request is therefore out of order. I now appeal my own ruling and call for the yeas and nays. The clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Grassley.
Those present unanimously approved suspending the quorum requirement and then cast similar votes advancing both nominees out of committee and on to the full Senate floor for an up or down vote. Immediately after, Chairman Hatch ordered all rules reactivated. Both nominees met fierce opposition during hearings and in the hallways of Congress. Mnuchin, tapped to lead the Treasury Department, is a hedge fund manager and Hollywood insider known for his offshore banking activities and his role in the foreclosure crisis that gripped the nation in 2008. Health and Human Services hopeful, Georgia Republican Dr. Tom Price, is a longtime foe of the Affordable Care Act and of reproductive rights, supports replacing Medicare with vouchers, and has questionable financial ties to the health sector. Capitol Police arrested 47 people outside Senator Hatch's office Tuesday, protesting a repeal of the ACA and opposing Congressman Price as head of Health and Human Services. The political maneuvers appeared headed for a replay at the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Democrats refused to attend Wednesday, delaying action on the nominee for EPA Administrator, Scott Pruitt. Nell Abram, FSRN.
And now here's Bill Newman of the American Civil Liberties Union with another reminder of what's at risk if we don't defend our constitutional rights.
Does Donald Trump's delusion about winning the popular vote actually matter? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. 135 million ballots were cast in the November election. Donald Trump won the Electoral College, but he lost the popular vote by almost 3 million. Nonetheless, Trump continues to claim that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally and that all of those 3 to 5 million people voted against him. Curiously, none of those votes, according to Trump, were cast in the three states where the vote totals were extremely close and which three states' electoral votes decided the election in his favor, which demonstrates that his claim about the popular vote not only is untrue, but that it's really bizarre. The White House says this untruth must be true because the president believes it, which is also bizarre, fallacious, 1984-like logic. Unfortunately, Trump's insistence on this falsehood is not merely meaningless propaganda. The propaganda serves an important and insidious purpose: to embolden his attorney general, state legislatures, and federal judges to condone and institutionalize voter suppression to keep poor people, minorities, and people of color from voting in the future. In America today, the right to vote is under attack by the government, which means that democracy itself is in grave peril. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
The suspect charged with murder in Sunday's shooting that left six people dead at a Quebec City mosque has been described as a lone wolf, Canadian Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale said Monday. Alexander Bissonnette, a student at Laval University in Quebec City, has been charged with six counts of first-degree murder and five counts of attempted murder. Officials have said that the attack was one that would have been difficult to prevent. Witnesses said that Bissonnette indiscriminately fired into a crowd of worshippers, including men, women, and children. On Tuesday, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau requested that Fox News remove or retract an erroneous tweet that stated the shooter was of Moroccan descent. Fox News apologized for the error and quickly took down the tweet. Mass shootings are relatively uncommon in Canada, and Canadians are grappling with a terrorist attack targeting a house of worship. FSRN's Jessica Zarek has more from Montreal.
Six people are dead and 19 are wounded after masked gunmen opened fire in a Quebec City mosque during evening prayers Sunday night. As of Monday morning, five victims remain in critical condition. The Quebec City attack is one of the deadliest mass shootings in modern Canadian history. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau spoke about the shooting in a speech Monday before the House of Commons.
This was a group of innocents targeted for practicing their faith. Make no mistake, this was a terrorist attack. It was an attack on our most intrinsic and cherished values as Canadians, values of openness, diversity, and freedom of religion.
Police apprehended a suspect Monday in connection with the attack. Though officially no motive has been defined, this looks to be an act of white nationalism. The Islamic Cultural Center of Quebec, the mosque targeted in the deadly attack, is one of six in the greater area and gathers a regular congregation of 100 people. Though the center had not received any recent threats, a pig head was left on its doorstep during Ramadan celebrations last summer. Tonight, there will be vigils held in Montreal, Edmonton, and other cities across Canada to stand in solidarity with the Muslim community. Both Montreal and Gatineau municipal authorities have stated they intend to tighten the security around mosques. The provincial public security minister, Martin Cotillot, has expanded this claim to include other religious institutions. The attack came the same weekend that U.S. President Donald Trump issued an executive order indefinitely barring Syrian refugees and restricting the entry of citizens from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Jessica Sherrick, FSRN, Montreal.
For opponents of Betsy DeVos's appointment to Secretary of Education, it's 2 down, 1 to go. Republican Senators Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska announced today they will vote against her confirmation. With Democrats voting as a united bloc against DeVos, only one more Republican changing sides would block the appointment. She would be only the 10th cabinet nominee in U.S. history rejected by Congress.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Tuesday, January 31st, 2017. Israeli forces invade West Bank communities, stop construction of a home, and kidnap civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli forces ordered on Tuesday a Palestinian from the village of Kardala, east of Tobas in the northern Jordan Valley, to halt construction of both his home and the water pipeline, according to local sources. Staff from the Israeli Army Civil Administration notified Tariq Fukaha to stop the construction of his home. The army notified Fukaha to stop the work on a 2,000-meter-long water pipeline intended for agricultural purposes in the village. Israel rarely permits Palestinians to build in lands classified as Area C, which amounts to 60% of the occupied West Bank, and it's under full Israeli control, including the Jordan Valley, leaving residents no choice but to build homes without permits. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers invaded early Tuesday the West Bank city of Hebron and abducted one Palestinian from his home. The soldiers also summoned a former political prisoner from the nearby Beit Ula town for interrogation. Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded on Tuesday at dawn Beit Fajar and Taqwa towns in the West Bank district of Bethlehem, searched many homes before abducting one Palestinian and summoning 4 others for interrogation. Also on Tuesday, Israeli authorities ordered the eviction of Amuna Israeli settlement outpost within 24 hours in preparation to demolish it by February 8th. Amuna, located near the West Bank city of Ramallah, was built on private-owned Palestinian land where 40 settler families are currently living. The court rule came after Palestinians successfully petitioned Israeli courts for the outpost removal. Israel's Supreme Court had ordered the outpost to be demolished by December 25th, but after the residents reached an agreement with the Israeli government to relocate, the demolishing date was postponed by 45 days. Israeli settlements built on the West Bank are illegal under international law. Thanks to settlements, the number of Israeli settlers all over the West Bank now height over 420,000. In other news, dozens of relatives of Palestinians killed during the 2014 Israeli military offensive on Gaza Strip broke into the office of the Palestine TV on Tuesday. The family members entered the building in At-Tal al-Hawa neighborhood of Gaza City, demanding to be given an opportunity to appear live on Palestinian TV and discuss their demands to the Palestinian Authority. One day earlier, members of the committee had shut down an office of the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, Association for Families of the Wounded and Martyrs, to protest national organization's failure to transfer allowances. The 50-day offensive caused the death of 2,251 Palestinians. 1,462 of them are civilians, and the death of 72 Israelis, 5 of them civilians, according to the UN documentation. And that's all for today from the IMMC News. This was the Tuesday, January 31st, 2017 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.immc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. U.S. Representative Mark Pocan says Andy Puzder should be rejected as U.S. Labor Secretary.
President Trump likes to tweet and talk about putting hardworking Americans first, but at the end of the day, he wants to make sure only big businesses and special interests have seats at the table, and that's why he nominated Andy Puzder.
Puzder ran fast food company CKE, operating the Hardee's and Carl's Jr. franchises. Puzder opposes increasing the minimum wage and overtime protections. His company has been repeatedly cited for labor law violations. AFL-CIO Vice President Tafari Gebre.
The AFL-CIO strongly urges the Senate to defeat this reckless nominee. Seems like if you don't believe in public education, President Trump thinks you should be running the Department of Education. If you don't believe in workers' rights, you should be running the department that's created to protect workers. If you don't believe in protecting the environment, you should be in charge of the EPA. We are willing to fight. We're willing to take it on the street. We're willing to do anything to provide the backbone to the Senate to do the right thing and reject this nomination.
60% of all Americans like labor unions, according to a new Pew Research poll. Three-quarters of young people aged 18 to 29 years old approve of labor unions. The poll shows 76% of Democrats approving of labor unions. Even 55% of young Republicans say they like unions. But while unions enjoy 60% public approval, the Pew poll found just 44% of Republicans overall approve of labor unions. For decades, the Gallup poll has also shown consistent strong public approval of unions in the U.S., but anti-union politicians keep getting elected and enacting anti-union policies. Either decades of polling is wrong, or the system used to elect politicians just might not reflect the popular will of the people. The Pew poll also found nearly 60% public approval of corporations. It found that Republicans like corporations, though, way more than labor unions.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield National Labor Office, empowering working Americans with stable health coverage for over 50 years. The National Labor Office is committed to remaining the top choice for the 17 million union workers, retirees, and families they serve. Online at bcbs.com/NLO. Brought to you by the California Teachers Association, 325,000 educators who know quality public schools make a better California for all of us. Information on how California teachers are shaping a stronger future for our kids is online at cta.org.
If you like WIN, don't forget to like Workers Independent News on Facebook. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If you receive a phone call and the person on the other end quickly asks, "Can you hear me?" or a similar yes-no question, do not say yes. Hang up the phone because in all likelihood, this is a scam. The Better Business Bureau is warning people that if you say yes, the scammers can edit this and use it to make it seem you have agreed to a major purchase, such as travel or timeshares. The Bureau is advising people to use caller ID and consider not answering unfamiliar numbers and let the call go to voicemail. They have warned the public that scammers may change the questions as word of this trick gets out. They advise everyone to be on the alert for any call where someone is asking a question where they are trying to get a direct yes answer. The Better Business Bureau says people lose about $50 billion a year to scammers, and about half of that is phone scams like this.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Khalid Mosley. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Charity Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Ray Bodwell. coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, Joanne Hardesty welcomes Jessica Jackson Sloan, mayor of Mill Valley, California, and founder of Cut 50, a group dedicated to cutting the prison population in half. At 9, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you news you're not supposed to know on her counter-propaganda call-in talk show. At 9:30, Fight the Empire welcomes Daniel Lazar to discuss the mainstream media's Vladimir Putin obsession and how he's scapegoated for the U.S. election outcome and more. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentaries. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. At 11, Between the Covers talks to Max Nemtsov about his Russian translation of the classic Gravity's Rainbow. At 11:30, Black Book Talk presents Portland native Renee Watson and her new Piecing Me Together. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Aaron.
Good night, Ray. And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your